Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu. As the weather outside gets increasingly more threatening and terrible, we're going to try to bring you delightful.
Yeah, my goodness, you're such a wimp. We only have 4 inches of snow on the ground.
Yes. Anyhow, today's a good program.
Today is always, there's always a good program.
I guess so.
But we've got a very special one starting out, because this Karen Page is really something.
Oh, she's amazing. Yeah.
So why don't we just let her explain why she's exactly. So amazing?
Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, we've been talking to you. We were trying to remember how many years, because we talk to you every time you have a new book coming out. And this is what number?
I think it's number 11. Although I got the dates wrong of how long we've been talking to you, because I think in our memory it's been forever and ever. But it's a little bit, a few years less than forever and ever, I just learned. But yes, this is book number 11, Creativity.
It's been a good long time. Now Andrew, you're sneaking around here. You only took the pictures here.
Yeah, it was really great to be able to work on this project with Karen, because she would interview these chefs and other experts, and they would make points. We'd really want to be able to illustrate them. So it was great to be able to have her input and her inspiration to try to make her interviews and all these incredible quotes and chefs and come alive.
Well, most of these people in the book I know, and so I realize how absolutely characteristic of the pose, the glance, and all these photographs, how authentic it all is to them.
Oh, I think Andrew did a great job of capturing it. And again, that's a real benefit of having a photographer on the team as opposed to working with one who's just shooting photographs after the fact. I mean, he was there really documenting these discussions as a photojournalist and really capturing moods and people. And I think the personalities do come across.
Yes, I do too.
It's an absolutely astounding book. There's no question
about
it.
The name of it again for people who never
call it Kitchen
Creativity.
But
unlocking culinary genius with wisdom, inspiration, and ideas from the world's most creative chefs. And as I said to Karen before we started the live interview, when are you going to pick something easy to write about?
Well, if it was easy, then the book would already exist, and there wouldn't be anything creative about coming up with a new book. But with a topic like kitchen creativity, we looked around for the kind of book that we wanted to read, and it didn't exist on the topic. So we realized we had to write it, and that's sort of a common theme when it comes to all of our books, whether it's the Flavor Bible or Culinary Artistry or What to Drink with What You Eat or anything else. We're looking for the answers, and if we can't find them, then we're going to talk to the people that we know have the answers, who in this case are the world's most creative chefs, people like Eric Repair and Dan Barber and Danielle Ballou and Patrick O'Connell and a whole host of chefs all across the country, and to have a chance to speak with them about the creative process, something that is so elusive, and yet these chefs offered insight after insight after insight into what allows them to be creative and to come up with new dishes or to come up with new solutions for social problems through food. We cover the whole gamut in the book.
Now, what gave you the idea of creating this book in the first place? And then I have a follow-on question to that.
Sure. Well, you know, I think with all of our books, it's creativity is sort of an underlying theme, and in this book it just takes center stage. So when you look at the research and it says that CEOs have called creativity the number one most essential trait for success in the business world today, and I think that's true in every single profession that you could name, that in the business world, it surpasses integrity, for better or for worse. It surpasses global thinking. That creativity is really the number one trait for success. And so only one out of every four people, Americans, believe that they've achieved their creative potential. So we really wanted to understand creativity first and foremost, and who better, if you're Karen and Andrew, to learn from than some of the world's most creative chefs. And so we turned to them, and I do think that our work has celebrated the fact that chefs are among the most creative professionals in the world today, the same way that you used to want to celebrate painters or poets or musicians and their creativity. Today, I think chefs, between their roles as culinary artists and entrepreneurs and activists really do tap creativity in all different kinds of ways and have such insightful things to say about their best practices in doing so.
Now, honest answer to this question, because you told us already it took more than 4 years to write it. How long did you think it would take when you started? and my guess is less than four.
Good question. You know, I think creativity is one of those topics that you start studying, and it's sort of like unraveling a sweater that's like infinitely large, and you just keep pulling and pulling. You think, you know, I got to get to the end somewhere, and it just never comes. So we could have gone on. I think with this book, we ended up cutting a lot that hopefully we'll be able to use in another project somewhere down the line, or that we'll be able to turn into something else. But we gathered so much information and really put the best of the best of it into Kitchen Creativity. But you know, as it is with over 450 pages, there are so many insights and tips and suggestions and really so much wisdom and advice from these chefs that we put the very best of it there, and I think that it really stands on its own.
Now, you sort of launched the book on the concept of the enlightenment moment for Farah and Adria with the asparagus ice cream, which, by the way, I asked Peter that I needed to have that in 1972. And never did get it. But anyhow...
I left at her, and she's been kicking me under the table ever since.
But the thing is that... he now has gone on, well, first of all, he's stimulated a whole new direction in culinary experience in this country, anyhow. But he went on, he is now in process of setting up and operating an entire investigative institution on this subject. I mean, didn't that overwhelm you at all?
Did what overwhelm us?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're writing this in a book, but he actually has a whole institution that has addressing this issue.
Well, culinary students can't carry around an institution in their backpacks, and most professional chefs can't either. So I think having a book like Kitchen Creativity that really distills down things that you might want to take for inspiration, whether it's on a train ride, in the subway, on a plane ride across country, wherever you're looking for inspiration, and have a few minutes to dip into some of the thoughts of some of the world's greatest chefs. We've got more than 100 of the world's greatest restaurants are represented in Kitchen Creativity. And whether it's how they came up with a particular signature dish that might be surprising, or the criteria that their chefs use whenever they're creating a new dish in their kitchen, we've got tips from, you know, Danielle Hume at 11 Madison Park, which was named the number one restaurant in the world. So what he uses as criteria in coming up with the new dish, the world's best, or rather America's best pastry chef, Gaia Oliveira, at Restaurant Danielle in New York City, what she does in terms of coming up with new desserts, which includes talking to her ingredients, and I mean literally talking to them, and she finds that they answer her and she can understand, and that's what inspires a new apple dish or a new dessert that she's working on. And it's fascinating to get to hear what chefs really do when they're trying to be creative.
Now, you introduce the subject when you say kitchen and define it as a room in which food and drink are prepared and cooking is done. Creativity, the ability to conceive ideas and or make things that are original, meaningful, and surprising. Now, most of these chefs have their own way of achieving that, which you narrate. But in general, most of these chefs are in agreement with that definition.
Yes, and I think a questionable word might be meaningful, because what's meaningful to me might not be meaningful to you. And it was interesting, a lot of in the molecular gastronomy / modernist cuisine movement, some of these dishes were intriguing and unusual, but were they meaningful? And I found that there were some that I've been served in restaurants that have left me flat.
Yes.
I don't know about you, yes, but you've indeed eaten around quite a bit as well, so I would suspect might have had that experience once or twice. And so I think that's really the evolution of meaning is really where we're at in 2017, where chefs are redefining, well, what's important to me? Is it doing a foam that tastes like black garlic, or is it coming up with a way to serve more than 2 million people in Puerto Rico who don't have access to electricity and can't cook for themselves. How can Jose Andres and his team solve that problem through
food? We saw him just after he got back from the first round, and he totally had laryngitis.
Yeah, oh, I bet. All the media interviews, all the working, shouting to his crew.
Yeah,
I can imagine that was the case. But and I understand he also lost. Yeah, I don't know. 20, 30, 40 pounds?
Oh, yeah, he did, by the way. I didn't notice that before he mentioned it.
It was looking good. It was kind of a necessary goal.
Yeah.
Well, but he's one of the most extraordinary chefs we know. I mean, of many extraordinary chefs that we know. And it's, I think, really emblematic of his definition of creativity that he chose to do what he did. He got on one of the first commercial flights, as I understand it, down to Puerto Rico in order to see what he could do to help, and didn't leave for days and days and days until he had fed more people than the Red Cross.
Oh, yeah, or anything, yes. I want to do as much justice, although we cannot do full justice to this extraordinary book, but let's break down what actually is in it, like contents. I'm looking at, you have part one, the creative process.
Yes.
Well, why don't you define this?
Well, we divide the book into two parts. Part one is really outlining the creative process, as you said, Anne, so beautifully. And part two is sort of that trademark Karen and Andrew style A to Z guide, a world of infinite culinary possibilities. So it's an alphabetical list from A to Z of basically anything you would ever want to inspire you in the kitchen other than flavor. So whereas in the Flavor Bible, we've got that three-column format that lists every ingredient from apples to zucchini and all the herbs, spices, and other seasonings that best enhance their flavor. In Kitchen Creativity, what we have under A to Z is things like under L, Leonardo da Vinci, and under C, Christmas, and under A, Ayurvedic cuisine, and under F, Father's Day, and under I, inspiration. And so there's quotes, and there's tips from chefs, there's lots of dish ideas, things like F for food waste. You can find all kinds of tips on how to eliminate food waste and some of the really intriguing ideas that chefs are practicing, using things like strawberry tops in pesto rather than throwing them away, really turning them into a delicious pesto for pasta, which we had in South Carolina when we were down there this summer for a wedding. So lots and lots of ideas about everything under the sun that could inspire you no matter what you're looking for.
This is my favorite section of the book. I pictured you and Andrew sitting there talking about what would be included in the A to Z.
It was one of the funnest discussions, and it was also one of the funnest things to photograph. You can look up, actually, s'mores. And Karen and I, again, were down in the South, and this person was doing s'mores pies to order with, chocolate ganache, and they put on the fluff and then torch it right there. And so, the inspiration can come from anywhere, and I think that's the exciting part about the book, especially as a cook. I can open up winter and see all the winter pastas and, winter wines and beers and all these and vegetables. So it's a lot of fun. Again, we just try to make it, you just open the book and find inspiration. And that's what Karen set out to do, and the design team helped her execute that. It's really inspiring that way.
I want to preamble my question because I want you to know where it's coming from. But there's a wonderful, highly creative chef in Spain called Carme Ruscalleda. She has a restaurant in just outside Barcelona, one in Barcelona where her son is the chef, and one in Japan where a group of investors persuaded her to go once a month to have a restaurant there because they were so impressed with what she was doing in São Paulo de Mar
and
Costa Brava.
She had to execute a painting.
I think they gave her a painting and then they said, do a menu that looks like that. But we had this challenge of interviewing her because we don't speak very, very much Spanish. And she, it turns out, didn't speak very much English. So we did have a member of her staff there trying to do a real-time translation.
Mm-hmm.
And then it suddenly dawned on me that what we absolutely had to do is we had to get the question translated into Spanish for her and then allow her to answer it in Spanish.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It was the first time we did that. It was about 10 years ago at least. And then we got someone to translate it and put a stereo track with English on top of it.
Mm.
But the key thing was that she was able to speak freely because she was speaking in a language that allowed her to say everything that she wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did you find dealing with that? Many of the chefs are some of America's finest, but you also have the world's finest, and we know some of them either don't or won't speak English.
Don't or won't is a good way of putting it.
Now, how did you find that?
Yes, well, we conducted our interviews in English, at this point, some of the world's best chefs have been interviewed so many times that sometimes you can often glean from, for example, from their cookbooks. They will really distill down some of the insights into the way that they think about their culinary philosophy. For example, we talk about different chefs have their mission statements. If you look under M for mission statements in the back of the book in the A to Z section, you'll find all kinds of chefs who talk about what's important to them. And it's chefs not just across the United States, but chefs from around the world. And so you'll see one chef's what he calls his octa philosophy, the eight different principles that are important to him. You'll find other chefs who are really limited to the ingredients that they can find within a 100-mile radius, or in some cases even a 12-acre radius of where they cook. And so you're seeing such differing inspirations for what goes into the cuisine that they create, and yet you find the same extraordinary level of creativity. And I think that's what Andrew and I found most fascinating when we were researching kitchen creativity, is that this creative level, that there were practices that each of those chefs, wherever they were located around the world, tended to really exemplify, and that was sort of this alternation between stimulation and stillness, as we call it in the book.
Right.
That stimulation through, eating out, through travel, through reading, and yet taking time to reflect in stillness, whether that was through a meditation practice or through martial arts or long-distance running or cycling, that they would take that opportunity to reflect on all the stimulation, and that's when the creative insights would come up. And that's where the ideas stem from. And so the inspiration was that combination of seeking out new stimulation, but also giving it the opportunity to blossom through the coming of insight.
You have an historical perspective in this book. I thought that was interesting, too. What dishes were introduced, what decade kind of thing. But clearly you're looking to the future also.
Always. I think you always have to have one foot in the past and one foot in the future and stand right. That's really where the present stands.
How do you see the future?
Well, I think it's what each of us choose to make of it. And I think that's the beauty of creativity, is that each of us has creative potential, whether we think of ourselves as being creative or not, that we have the opportunity to take what's important to us, what we believe about food, what's important to us about food, whether it's maintaining tradition or turning tradition on its ear, whether it's eating whatever the heck we want to eat, or whether it's serving our guests only the most nutrient-dense ingredients we can possibly find and rising to the challenge of making them taste as delicious as they possibly can. And I think each of us, through those individual choices, is going to collectively create the future of food. And I think that's really the exciting part of it, is that we can take it anywhere we want to take it.
And it never stops moving forward.
No. Well, if it did, I don't think any of us would be around to notice. Yes, I hope it does, and it will continue to, and I envision that it will for a long, 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 long time to come.
Well, you've got just a marvelous cast of characters in this book, some really thoughtful people. I love the picture of Patrick O'Connell.
Oh, yeah.
Outstanding in his field in so many ways.
Little Washington, wearing his garish chef gear.
And those shoes. Yeah, green.
And enjoying a glass of wine in the middle of the day.
That's Patrick.
And then you've got the almost the opposite, the phlegmatic one.
Who's that?
Thomas Keller.
Oh, Thomas.
who refuses to wear anything other than white, and then dark blue with white stripes.
Oh, we have some wonderful quotes from Thomas Keller in the book.
Yeah,
he's so wise when it comes to things like flavor. He's really thought about the very specific aspects of it, whether it's seasoning, enhancing flavor through just the right salt. I mean, he's really a perfectionist about so many things.
Yeah, I've seen him setting up a mise en place when I was at the French Laundry years and years ago. But you know, salt, by the way, keeps reappearing in your book, which I think is interesting, because I don't know how many chefs we've interviewed that said that's the hardest thing to teach anybody.
Absolutely.
And they're still saying it, which is really fascinating, too. And I think it's fascinating that they all have their preferred salts, and then Karen also came up with different salting agents, so it's not just the salt that the best chefs use, but it's like having Parmesan on hand or feta or some other thing that will bring salt to a dish to give it a better depth of flavor, maybe even more umami.
Yeah, this could be a manual for cooking, actually, too, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if anybody who loved the Flavor Bible, I think this is the book that is meant to really turbocharge their use of the Flavor Bible in the kitchen. If they understand the basic flavor equation that we've laid out, that flavor is more than taste. Flavor is taste plus aroma plus texture and temperature and the X factor and
yeah,
so
I
many
like
factors
that
come
too.
Together.
Yeah, I love that section, too, by the way. So many sections.
Did anybody actually tell you, I'm running out of creative juice, and is that a danger?
I think a lot of chefs will go through periods where they might, you know, have a dry spell, and usually what it's telling them, it's life telling them they need a vacation, or it's life telling them that they need to pause and come back to it afresh. And really, those are some of the tips that we share in Kitchen Creativity, that people can, when we've got, you know, how to triple your creativity, and there's lots of, we also have a list of the Kitchen Creativity 50. So lots of ideas that will spark you when you're at that moment where you're not feeling creative, if you're feeling stuck. And a lot of times it's just a matter of, like, you know, leave the room. If you're standing up, sit down. If you're sitting down, stand up. You know, go for a walk around the block. Really change your perspective, because a lot of times not feeling creative is feeling stuck in a rut. And if you can change your perspective on that same carrot that's in front of you that you're trying to figure out what the heck to do with, then that different perspective that you come back to it with after you've taken that walk around the block, or after you've turned on the television and seen an ad for something that had, you know, mentions a Mexican dish, and you start thinking about cilantro, and you start thinking about a Mexican direction, you can take your dish in. I mean, inspiration is only a song away. It's only a painting away. It's only one meditation away.
One
There's
sheet
so
of
many
white
ways you can keep it fresh.
Remember the white bull? What's his name? Who was that? Hemingway
had the white bull.
Yes.
It occurs to me there was something I meant to mention along the way through. One of the remarkable things about Ruscalleda's restaurant is that it has windows.
In the kitchen.
Mm.
So the chefs, as they're cooking, can look out the window.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen that anywhere else.
Big windows.
Well, Jean-Georges, right on Columbus Circle in New York City, I think there are some very envious chefs when they saw that he and his team had these beautiful windows when that opened up, probably around 1997, 1998.
Well, I think that you've given us a lot of reasons to explore our own inspiration and creativity.
In whatever you do. I mean, I think it's...
Yeah. These
will transfer.
Yes, right? Exactly.
The goal.
To understand creativity in one field is to understand it in all fields, and I hope everybody who listens applies it to their own life.
So on the menu needs to go for a walk around the block. Thank you so much for joining us. Once again, congratulations on a truly beautiful piece of work.
Thank you so much, Peter and Anne. Always a pleasure to speak with you both.
We did tell you she was amazing. Now you know. Now you really know. This is a book you want under your tree, or you want it on your coffee table, or you want it in your kitchen table, wherever you want it. There's a minefield of information here, and wonderful things just to read and marvel at. Right?
Yes.
And
I don't know about this minefield.
Minefield. Well, I don't know what I was thinking about a minefield for.
I don't know either.
I was watching a rerun of MASH the other day, and this little Korean boy got stuck in the middle of a minefield. Made me think of mines, I guess.
Okay. Anyway, here,
yeah,
or there. Or right.
No, time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up is Bill Esparza, who was legitimately Mexican. And you could look at this title of his book, and you could say maybe it's La Mexicana, or more accurately, Los Angeles Mexicana. And that's a particular type of cuisine so that you find in the Los Angeles region. He could explain the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of Mexicans in Los Angeles for a very long time. And that's the start of it right there. But there are more factors at work and a manifestation of that kind of cuisine all over the great Los Angeles area.
Right.
We're going to be talking to Bill Esparza about Los Angeles Mexicana. Or you could say La Mexicana, right, Bill?
Yes.
It works out.
L.A. Mexicano. Los Angeles Mexicano.
Yes. Nobody else is focused. Your focus here is on a particular style of cooking in Los Angeles and the fact that it happened and in quite a volume as opposed to, I'd say, other figures who get the spotlight. This is real indigenous Los Angeles, isn't it?
It is. You're absolutely right. It is divided into four groups of four styles of cuisines that exist in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Mexican scene. So you have we have a lot of regional food. We have, at any one time we have half of the states of Mexico represented in some form. And we also have Mexican American cuisine, which is, again, it's something that's been passed over and people have made fun of it. People think it's not serious cuisine. They think it's not real Mexican food. And so we talk about that. We're also talking about our street vendors, which are, again, a lot of them are regional, but we also have some very innovative street vendors. And
Gorilla Tacos sounds really interesting.
Yes, and Chef Wes Avila is part of this whole movement that's happening called Alta California Cuisine, which is, it's really a local style of Mexican cooking, and it reminded me a lot of, what I've studied about Alta California when it was part of Mexico and how it was so far away from the rest of the country that it developed its own unique style based on the immigration patterns of Mexicans coming in from other parts of the country, as well as people coming in, settling in from what would become, part of the United States, Americans. And this unique interaction that was happening. And today, you have these young Mexican-American chefs that they've been trained in all the top California cuisine restaurants. They've worked up in San Francisco and here in L.A. And they're surrounded by this amazing produce and this a multicultural city. But their upbringing and their background is Mexican. They've lived in Mexican neighborhoods.
Now, what are some of the characteristics of this Alta Mexican cuisine?
Well, so unlike, for instance, you take Enrique Olvera in Mexico City, and so he grew up in, surrounded by all the Mexican foods that were available in his area. So when you go to his restaurant, you get these incredible takes on all these little street foods, and he's got such a repertory of dishes to choose from, and all the Mexican chefs do. The Mexican American chefs don't, because when, depending on when their family came, only a handful of foods survive, and so you don't have that depth of antojitos, all those little different masa shapes. We have tamales, we have tacos, we have burritos, we have chilaquiles, we have enchiladas, kind of like the basics, sopes and things like that. And so these young chefs they've grown up with those foods. And now instead of, focusing on all the different styles or the styles of street foods or all the regional dishes. They're more focused on what they can do with the local produce. So a taco is no longer just with meat inside of it or al pastor or even, you know, some kind of braise or stew. It's all the California ingredients, you know.
Well, you know, it's amazing how many, you call them, non-Mexican chefs all over the world are nuts about tacos. Why is that?
Well, yeah.
I mean, you have Noma. What's his name? Rezepi is nuts about tacos. Renee, he's the number one restaurant in the world, and he's crazy about tacos. And then what's the guy in New York that I like so much, Rabbit, who has two or three restaurants?
Alex.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I mean, I got my new guacamole recipe from him. I use pistachio oil and pistachio nuts. Now, that's not authentic, but I love it.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, these things are being done in Mexico, too. You know, I mean, you know, like the interesting takes on guacamole. But, well, here's the thing. I mean, ultimately, Rene Redzepi is a little late on the bandwagon. I mean, the taco craze started many years before he got excited about it. But I would say right now, yes, we're at a time where probably the taco is the most popular food in the United States.
But why?
The most popular dish. I think it's just because, you know, it would be one of those things that would be hard to explain, right? But Enrique Olvera said one time that he goes tacos are not, he goes, they're not just a dish, they're a way of life. And so it's one of those foods, you know, there are these types of foods that they don't, they exist in their own world. Like, you have breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and people don't say, let's go dine on tacos, or let's have tacos for dinner.
Right.
I mean, people just say, let's go have tacos. Mm-hmm. So that can happen any time of the day. Mm-hmm. So, you guys want to go to brunch? No, I want to get tacos. So tacos are not included in brunch, they're not included in breakfast, even though they're served at those times. So, but it's also this, and then people want, you know, people will say, well, we want the real tacos. Well, what they mean when they say that is that they want to stand out on the street or a corner somewhere. They want to watch the taquero do his work. They want to have that interaction. They want to, you know, it's like you get to see the cooking going on, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when you go to a restaurant that has an open kitchen.
Right.
The taco stand always has, sorry about that, the taco stand always has an open kitchen, and you're right there, and the guy's handing it to you. It's just like you're at a sushi bar. You're getting handed a taco, which you are expected immediately to dress and devour, and then you ask for more. So it's really an experience, and it's a lifestyle. It's like in Mexico, all classes go out to have tacos. That's the one thing that's very new in the United States. But it used to be the tacos you only had if you were in the Mexican community or if you were a hipster, right? But now everybody wants to try tacos, so tacos are coming to their neighborhood, and that really is the Mexican experience. It's like it doesn't matter if you're a Carlos Slim, you know,
yeah,
one of the richest men in the world, or if you're just a regular, you know, blue collar worker, you eat tacos. You know, and you have it at a stand or one of these places, you know.
Now, here's a funny thing I'd like you to comment on, because your book describes Mexican food in a very rich manner. I mean, there's an enormous variety of things that are in there. But when Anne and I were in Mexico together, which was 2000, I think, I was doing some work down there for General Motors to Mexico, and the first week we were down there, Anne came with me, and she bummed around Mexico City while I was at work. But three things happened that were interesting. We went to one restaurant. This is in Mexico City. We went to one restaurant which served only fish.
Oh, yeah. That was a good
restaurant. And the advice we got was, go to this place early because they close at 8 o'clock. So when we got there, we asked them, the food, by the way, was really excellent.
Fabulous.
And they had this wonderful wash station. With hot and cold running water they brought around to your place after you had eaten something fishy with your fingers.
Right.
We asked them, why do you close at 8 o'clock? And they said, well, real Mexicans don't eat fish after 8 o'clock. If they're dining after 8 o'clock, they eat meat.
That's not true altogether, but that's what he said.
We asked him why they closed so early.
But that's not. I've been to Mexico many times, and
now same thing. And I can picture this place on in my mind, and I can tell you where it is, but only because it's out the back door of the JW Marriott in Mexico City.
Oh right,
in Polanco, I think, isn't it? The suburb.
Yeah,
Polanco.
And we were looking for somewhere to eat, and we didn't want to go very far, so we walked out the back door, and there was this restaurant just across the street. And the only thing was it didn't pass the full parking lot test. There was nobody there. We thought, well, we're going to go anyway because we don't want to go any further. So we went about 7 o'clock. By the time we left at 9 o'clock, the place was absolutely packed.
Yep.
Mexicans are a little bit like their Spanish neighbors, I guess, and they eat late, a lot later than we do.
And what's the third thing?
So this is not Mexico City. LA Mexican dining is not like Mexican dining in Mexico City, I guess is the point I'm trying to get across. I forgot what the third thing was.
The whole point of this book is that it's not like
I'm trying to get the message across.
Own kind of cuisine.
Hold on, I'm trying to get this across to our listeners because they don't have the book in front of them. you have the advantage that you have the book.
You brought up a very good point, and in Mexico, there are specialists, and there are specific days and even times for dining. You find this all throughout Latin America. You know, so the tacos that are available on the weekend are different than the ones during the week. The ones that are available in the morning have a different, offering than what's in the afternoon and the evening. You're right. In the evening, you can be right next to the ocean, and there's like, you can even see the fish jumping, and it's nighttime, and they're not going to serve you fish. They're going to serve you carne asada. Or some kind of grilled meats. Because we have all these traditions that are just rituals that you grow up with.
I remember the third thing, by the way.
You don't know why you get barbacoa only on the weekends, but you grow up doing that, you know? And so it becomes just programmed, you know? It's like every society has things that they're programmed to do. In the United States, we're so horrible at so many things, but we're very good at pulling over when there's an ambulance or a fire truck. We are very good at that. And obviously, everybody knows why we do it, but I've been to many countries where people just don't even move at all when the ambulance and the fire truck are coming. So we're programmed. People in Singapore are programmed not to litter, and Mexicans are programmed to go get barbacoa on Saturday. You know, and so
Bill, I remember the third thing, and funnily enough, it fits in with what you were just saying to an extent. On this trip to Mexico City, we had a liaison who spoke fluent Spanish. And
he was Spanish, wasn't he?
He was Spanish speaking, very, very fluent. And he was going to take us to this wonderful place where they had tamales. Because this was the best place in Mexico City to have tamales,
right,
according to him. So we went there at lunchtime, and he tried to order tamales, and they wouldn't sell him any. They had tamales. They had tamales in the kitchen.
But tamales
were for cena. Tamales were for dinner. They were not for lunch. It doesn't matter how good your Spanish is. You're still not going to get any tamales.
Yeah, exactly. No, we're very strict about it. It's regional things, and like you know, going back to barbacoa, people don't want it unless you're from Hidalgo or the state of Mexico. If you advertise, hey, I got this Nayarit barbacoa, no one's going to go there because people only want like certain people to do those things, you know. So you have to be from, if you want to be successful selling birria, you have to be from Jalisco, you know. Mm-hmm. So the thing about Mexican-American cuisine, the way it's very different in that way, is that we don't have the strict eating times and rituals, because you're dealing with people from all over Mexico, and they might not even know those foods. You know, they might get invited by another friend they know, and that they're not from that state. They don't have those traditions, and so it's kind of new to them. There's a guy in the book, Paco Perez, who has the aquí es Texcoco. And the one of the funniest things I ever heard. Well, I mean, it just was funny because it shouldn't be weird, but it is weird. And there's a chef from Mexico City named Yair Tellez, who's very famous.
Yes.
And he was in town, and he saw this place, aquí es Texcoco, when we were driving by, and he started laughing, and he was like, he just said, oh no, it's the funniest thing. He goes, barbacoa at night. Like, and for him, it just was like completely, you know, like something radical. So it's like something like a taboo. You don't have barbacoa at night. So Paco has a restaurant that does barbacoa 7 days a week, you know, for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner. People come in and have lamb barbacoa, which is a weekend specialty, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we can do that here because we have a different kind of diner.
Yeah.
People don't mind eating seafood late. Seafood restaurants don't close at noon here. There might be street vendors that sell a limited supply of something, and they will sort of adhere to whatever that norm is, you know, by serving in the morning. You can find that. You can definitely find people who do morning foods and afternoon foods. And the carne asada vendors and all the grilled meat vendors don't come out till about 5 p.m., 6 p.m., just like in Mexico here.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, you can have birria all week long. You can have barbacoa all week long, and nobody's going to give you any crap about it, you know. So we are sort of anything goes here,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's really what's formed this wonderful Mexican American cuisine from, you know, from the combo plates on up through what Wes Avila's doing.
Let's talk a little bit about beer, because you mentioned that there are some things happening in beer which are definitely non-traditional, unlike the Corona, where you have to stick a lime in the bottle. I never did understand why. And then you have the most interesting man in the world who only drinks Dos Equis.
Yeah.
Now, right. Exactly.
Now,
exactly.
So,
yeah.
Some more things are happening with beer.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, so many. You're right. So many things have happened. The most interesting thing is that there's no such thing as Mexican beer anymore. It's all owned by foreign companies.
Right.
And so, like, so the Mexican national brands are all now owned by foreign companies. But craft beer movement in Mexico has exploded.
Right.
But
okay.
You know, we have some of those beers here in LA. But it doesn't make sense if you're a Mexican American chef and you want to have interesting beers to kind of wait for the Mexican craft beer movement. We have so many amazing craft beers in America, of course. And so our chefs are using, you know, American made and some European craft beers, because they just have a huge arsenal of flavors to choose from.
Got it. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So that's happening here. But really the big thing that we covered in the book is that, this guy, David Mora, who, along with other people in the Mexican neighborhoods of Boyle Heights, East LA, were sort of coming up at this time where they were hearing about craft beer, they were seeing commercials, they were being exposed to it when they go out to dinner, you know, because Boyle Heights is like, you know, one bridge away from, it's like a short trip over to downtown LA. It's like right next to it.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where all the craft beer stuff was happening. So people were going to these places, and they're like, then they go to their liquor store, and all they'd have is, you know, the beer from the most interesting man, you know, Dos Equis and Pacifico, Negra Modelo, all those. And literally the guys were going into the liquor store, into like Ramirez Liquors, and they were saying, you know what, can't you guys get anything else in here? We're tired of these beers. We're tired of, like, because we're Mexican, do we only have to drink these beers? I mean,
mm-hmm.
so Ramirez started getting all these other brands and these craft beers, and then I remember I would go to Ramirez to get tequila and mezcal, because they have the best selection in LA, one of the best places to go. And so I, you know, not being a real craft beer guy, I'd be shopping for Mezcal, and I'd look over and like, man, look at all that craft beer. I go, who's drinking that? You know, and that was before I was obviously aware of what was going on. But David, he saw that, and he decided to open a craft brewery with Tortas in right there in Lincoln Heights. And that was really, I mean, in a way, it's kind of the shot heard around the world, you know, that you can actually be successful serving craft beer to a Mexican audience. And, you know, the craft beer companies and the breweries that are opening up in L.A. just never really thought about, you know, do we want to, you know, they thought that their audience was only hipsters and that Mexicans aren't going to drink this stuff. So I think that's an amazing thing that's happening, and we're going to see more of that. And actually, you already are seeing more bars open up that are beer focused, and so you have our type of, you know, beer bar is, it has craft beer, but it also has, you know, lots of different micheladas, you know, because a lot of us like to just like, okay, well, whatever with the craft beer, I'll drink the craft beer if you throw a bunch of salt and Worcestershire sauce and all kinds of stuff in it, you know.
Yeah.
Now there was one recipe I looked for in the drink section, and I didn't see it. And that's this wonderful thing called sangrita.
Oh, yeah,
not sangria, sangrita.
That red stuff.
Yeah, but sangrita with tequila is very, you know, that's very 80s.
Oh,
know?
I see. Okay,
and,
all right.
Well, the thing is that here in Los Angeles, in the last 5 years, I would say that mezcal has become the dominant spirit, and you don't drink mezcal with sangrita.
Didn't we interview somebody about the mezcal?
We did, yes.
Yes.
I can't remember who it was, but we did.
A while ago, so it's now a full-fledged trend.
Yeah,
you know, can I pull back to this point? We could go on. We're talking on all these little details about it, but overall, what is somebody going to get? The message from this book, what is it?
The message of the book is about the Mexican community. And, you know, in all discussions about Mexican cuisine, Mexicans have been left out, whether it's on Food Network television, whether it's in magazines. I think what really bothered me a few years ago, I don't even remember what the publication was. There's all these groups that make these lists, you know, and they did the 100 best Mexican restaurants in the United States. And for the interview part, they only spoke to Jose Andres, Alex Dupac,
yeah.
and Rick Bayless.
Okay.
And I'm like, wait a minute,
right.
There's something wrong here.
Yeah,
you know, why are we not talking to the Mexican community? And then inevitably in these conversations, you know, that I remember actually it was a very prominent food critic in Los Angeles that was arguing with me on Facebook. And he said, well, look at, he was talking about Rick Bayless. He goes, well, you know, he's put in the time, he's put in the study, he lived there, and he did this, did that, basically trying to tell me his Mexican credentials, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the very first thing that he said was that he doesn't have to be Mexican. I go, well, wait a minute. You just described a Mexican, someone who lives in Mexico, who grew up, who studied the food. It's like you're trying to prove to me how much Mexican cred he is. How about Mexicans? Why do they not have this kind of cred? I mean, that's kind of a basic thing that every Mexican living in Mexico would have. I mean, the guy walking down the street that shines shoes, he has more cred than this guy, you know? And so for me, it's just that we need to hear from the Mexican community if we're talking about Mexican food, whether it's on, you know, in all media. And that's where it needs to start. And I think that it's been sort of this combination of media and the chefs with the PRs that they're only talking to each other. And they're forgetting, you know, like, where did I get this food? You know, where does this come from? You know, which community am I, you know, whatever chef goes to Oaxaca for 2 weeks and he opens a restaurant and then he's doing all the interviews about Oaxacan food.
Yeah, I know.
When we have the second largest Oaxacan restaurant scene in the world here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I love, you know, Oaxacan, like, cuisine.
Well,
but you know, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to all these places anyhow. And well, this trip that Peter was talking to you about, I mean, the fluent Spanish speaker and I were constantly arguing about where to go because he wanted the kinds of places that you're talking about. He wanted tacos and he wanted enchiladas and he wanted this and that and the other. I wanted to go to places that had a traditional Oaxacan, you know, not shrimp, but that was just thinking of that place in Mexico City that had the wonderful shrimp. Do you understand what I'm talking about? I'm not talking about that segment of dining. I'm talking about what Olvera is actually pushing. And is that in there? Is that in the in Los Angeles? Can I get that kind of food there? Or is it more?
Yes, we the thing is we have everything. We actually have more variety than Mexico City. Now I'm not saying we have better Mexican food.
I'm talking about elevated, cuisine as opposed to street food.
But it's happening with Mexican American chefs. So you have Mexican American chefs that are doing that and they're reflecting a local style of cooking, not a Mexican national style of cooking. So here's what's been really fascinating to me, and I think that really legitimizes the whole thing, is that Enrique Olvera, chefs like him and other prominent chefs have been bringing these young guys to Mexico, and Enrique brought Wes Avila out to New York to come with him. So their record, you know, in the past, the big-name Mexican chefs, when they had their chef events, they'd always invite people from France, from Italy, from Spain to come and cook, right? To get that international. They never considered United States because they didn't recognize what was happening there as being, some guy that has a restaurant is famous and he just makes mole. That's not really interesting to them, you know?
Yeah.
But the fact that you've had these young chefs that are innovating and doing something unique with the terroir of East LA and Huntington Park and all these wonderful neighborhoods, that has actually gained notice in Mexico. So we now have our own style of fine dining. And we also have people coming in here. Michael Calderon just came here from Mexico City and opened up. Diego Hernandez from the Valle de Guadalupe opened up last year.
Yeah, well, the whole Los Angeles food scene, this restaurant scene, has really exploded this past year. I know
it's
that.
Exploded.
Well,
yeah, Enrique's coming here.
Well, see, this is all really valuable information in this book. I just wanted to, we were sort of off on the side chatting about this, that, and the other, and I wanted a big overall picture of what people can expect when they buy this book, and you just articulated that, Bill. So, again, it's Bill Esparza, and it's L.A. for Los Angeles Mexicano. Recipes, people, and places. And we didn't talk even, one of the most interesting aspects of the book are your profiles of these cooks. So that's a whole other section. So I can only say, I think that it's really worth checking out this book. And you really worked hard on it and your heart's in it, and I congratulate you.
Thank you. It's wonderful talking with you guys about the book.
You too, Bill.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We've been long admirers of Julia Tershin. But boy, with this new book, she's really stepped out of her circle of comfort. Who knew that political activism fitted so well with recipes?
I don't know. I guess if you're out there demonstrating, you do get kind of hungry.
I guess so. But she has, her book is called Feed the Resistance. And it'll get you riled up. It's subtitled Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved. And Julia, the last time we interviewed Julia Tershin was about her cookbook called Small Victories, which was a brilliant cookbook. It was encouragement to really just jump in feet first and cook. This book is a little different, Julia. It's called Feed the Resistance, recipes plus ideas for getting involved. And I want to say right out at the start on that, you on the front cover, you say all the proceeds will be donated to the ACLU, which should give readers a rough idea, better than a rough idea, of what the book's about. But can you go into details, starting first of all with what gave you the idea for the book, and then what you really are talking about in the book?
Sure, of course, yeah. I'm delighted to talk about it. So, yeah, the book, as you said, it's called Feed the Resistance and Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved. And it is just both myself and a group of amazing and diverse contributors and essays and lists of ideas and resources and all of the material from the recipes to the essay about community and getting involved and connecting with people who maybe, you know, don't look like you or practice a different religion or anything like that. And it's very much about food as a means of both activism and as community building. And I got the idea to do the book because I've always cared very much about not just what food I'm cooking. You know, I work as a cookbook author. I love food. I love to cook. And I care, yeah, not only about the food that I'm cooking, but also about who I'm cooking it for and how can food make my community a better and more... and in the wake of the most recent election, so much divide in my own community and in the country, in the world. And to me, food has always been a way of crossing that divide. And so I thought I would put together this book I would get from lots of other people, so it's very much a community effort. And all of the proceeds do go to the American Civil Liberties Union. So this book is completely about giving back.
Now, the interesting thing is your previous book was called Small Victories. Now, I can't remember what it looked like and whether it was a small book or not, but this book is a small book.
Yes. Yeah, Small Victories was, it's a larger book.
Yeah. Book, okay.
It's definitely got more recipes. This book is very small. I keep describing it as, you know, it's a serious book, but it's very cute, just the size of it. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's the perfect, it's something, you know, it's sort of, it's very affordable. All the proceeds, as I mentioned, go to the ACLU. So, you know, as the gift buyer, you're doing something really beneficial to protect civil liberties. As the recipient of the gift, you're getting all this great content. So it's a wonderful gift, and it's sort of easy to take around with you. And the other reason it's small is because I put it together extremely quickly. Most cookbooks take about 2 years, and I pitched this book in March. It's out now in October, and in cookbook world, that's extremely fast. So.
No, it's also a book with some remarkable content. I noticed, for example, that you have the recipe for a perfect fried egg. And I'm relieved to say that that's exactly how I cook my fried eggs. I can also tell you that that's the way that Jose Andres, of Spanish cuisine fame, he also cooks his eggs that way.
And he's an amazing example of someone who uses food to give back.
Yeah, as we speak, he's cooking for thousands of people in Puerto Rico.
Is that where he is?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, John Besh is in the Virgin Islands, right?
John is there too. Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Besh is in the Virgin Islands, right, and Andres is in Puerto Rico.
So can you give us an example of how a particular recipe and a particular kind of event sort of come together? I mean, there are too many of them for us to go over all of them with you today, but there must be some that you think were particularly important.
Yeah, of course. There's so many wonderful recipes, and even better, all those recipes have incredible stories behind them, and I had all the contributors introduce their own recipes, so it's, you know, it's their stories and their voices. I'm not speaking for anyone in this book, and they
Can
sort
I
of all come to mind.
Here?
You
have a bunch of photos of the contributors in the back of the book, and I couldn't help but note how many women of color are listed in here.
Yes.
No,
yeah, that was very purposeful.
That. Yeah, okay, tell us about it.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you noticed that. When I
went through the process of, you know, figuring out who I was going to ask to contribute and then reaching out to them, I was thinking so much about representation and, you know, who we often see in cookbooks, who we hear from. I'm a white woman, so when I look at cookbooks, I often see myself reflected in the authors and their stories. And I know that that sense of visibility isn't available to everyone. So I wanted to do whatever I could to increase that that feeling and to expand the representation of, you know, who gets to have the recipes published. So the book is, the contributors are, the majority are people of color, the majority are women. They're from all over the country. You know, I didn't just stick to New York where I am. you know, because food and community and activism, these things happen everywhere. So I'm so glad you pointed that out. Absolutely.
Now, you have three major sections, I will call them, the approaches in the book. Easy meals for folks who are too busy resisting to cook. Feeding the masses, food for crowds, which should be an obvious thing, and baked goods, portable snacks. And I guess that's if you're out resisting, you need to have access to these. How did you come out with just those three things? I mean, it seems like there are a whole bunch of other who resist need to approach.
Yeah, I was thinking primarily about, again, when you're I wanted to give them some sort of framework for the book, but I didn't want to be prescriptive at all in what I was asking people to contribute. You know, I wanted, you know, people to, you know, feel free to offer whatever recipe meant something to them. And I thought of those sections because when I think about food and as it really intertwines with activism, you know, what are the settings in which we eat? And that first section was sort of a cheeky title of, you know, easy meals for people who are too busy resisting to cook. Mm-hmm. People who are activists, and whatever that means to you, you know, they tend to be busy.
Right.
So that section is really quick, easy, but, you know, not boring meals. The second section, the food for large groups, that's a big theme in people who cook, you know, for their communities. You're often feeding large groups of people. And then the final section, the baked goods and sort of portable snacks, you know, activists, again, are busy people. They tend to be on the go. And, you know, it could be as literal as maybe you're going to a march or a protest. But it could also be maybe you're driving your kid to school and need something, you know, you can all eat in the car. And all the recipes are, there's a few things that, even though they're all so different, there's a few things that kind of tie them all together. And one is that they're all really affordable. They call for really accessible ingredients that don't cost a lot of money. And then they all, for the most part, are kind of skewed sort of vegetarian and healthy.
Yes, I saw that too. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not every recipe in the book. There's definitely some really decadent, wonderful things. But for the most part, health is a bit of a theme because I think taking care of yourself and the people around you, and that includes, you know, what you eat, is important to, you know, keeping up your energy.
Yes. Now, the messages that people contributed, I'm looking at the Mickey Halpern.
Mm-hmm.
Helping. And it's something that I think a lot of us are guilty of. I know I am. It's called practical activism. If you want to do something, don't try to do everything. And I think that the book is filled with tips like that, that they seem obvious or self-evident, but, you know, they're not really. I mean, people have to be reminded of these things.
Absolutely. Yeah, Mickey's essay is wonderful.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And it's it was an essay she adapted from something she had written online, and it was something that I had read, and it really inspired me because I think so much about activism and the resistance is, I think we're constantly reminded that it's a marathon and it's not a sprint, and I think it's about finding what you can do and what you can commit to for the long haul, and, you know, not spreading yourself too thin.
Yeah, well, and you get to the heart of it with, you know, how food fits in with this, how food could be a platform for activism
Simile, is it?
Oh, Shakira Simile.
Yeah, how food could be a platform for activism. So you truly believe this?
I truly do. I think food is, you know, it's a lot of things. One, it's the thing that everyone in the world has in common. That in and of itself is just a huge sort of democratic thing that we all share, sort of democratic with like a lowercase d. You know, it's something that can connect all of us. And I think it's something that affects basically everything that matters. When you talk about food, when you think about it, when you think about the whole system, you know, the whole food system and where everything we eat comes from, you end up talking about the environment. You end up talking about immigrants' rights. You end up talking about economic justice and racial injustice. It touches on all of these things. And Shakira's essay that you brought up is such a beautiful piece of work, and it's as much about food being a platform for activism as it is about her own experience as a black woman in this country, her relationship with her brother. You know, it's personal. It's also a call to action. It's so many things, and it uses food as an access point. You know, she talks about having enjoying a Thai meal with her brother, and I think food is something that's also can be really fun, and it's a way to grab people's attention, and it's a way to sit down and be with each other. And I think in that sense food's a really powerful tool for change and activism, because it's easy to get excited about and get involved in.
Yeah, I almost cried my way through that essay.
I always a very said powerful that, writer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll always say that probably the hardest thing in the world actually is to be the mother of a young black man. I just think you have a section that should be useful to everybody, 20 places to reach out to. I must tell you that I was, I learned from reading some of these places where these people come from. I mean, the organizations and the activities that they represent. But you sort of bring it to to actual facts under this 20 places to reach out to, and then you go through the initial ones, then local, state, national, specific groups, and then 10 ways to engage that aren't so obvious. And I thought that was very important. Tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the resources in the back of the book. And those 20 places are, you know, it's a really great list of places to start reaching out to, whether you have needs that you need help with, or if you have help that you can give. And the 10 things you can do that aren't so obvious, again, touches on something we talked about earlier. It's about just really practical ideas and ways to get involved, and everything from, you know, helping make sure everyone around you is registered to vote and just asking if they are and just checking in. That kind of thing. And there's also a list of 10 things you can do in less than 10 minutes, which I included because I think, you know, I mentioned, you know, activism very much being a marathon, not a sprint, but I think we also live in a very instant gratification culture.
Yes.
And I wanted to give a list of things that you can actually do quite quickly that will make a difference, a really true and lasting difference. So yeah, there's definitely something for everyone, and there's so much beyond the book, too. I hope it's a jumping-off point for people to think of new ideas and connect with all sorts of places.
Well, I hope it's a successful book.
Thank you so much.
And so it's Julia Tershin's book called Feed the Renaissance, Recipes and Ideas. I mean, I'm sorry, Feed the Resistance. In the editing, we'll get rid of that.
It's a Freudian slip, I guess.
Yeah.
I like that.
I'd like it too. Feed the Renaissance. Feed the Resistance, Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved. I hope we do have a Renaissance, Julia.
I hope so too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to us, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, listeners, there you have it for another week. Christmas is rapidly approaching. We hope your plans are rapidly approaching too. But you still have time to check in with us, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.